This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. What do you think of okra? Well, Chris Smith says if you write off okra as just a slimy pod, you're doing it a great injustice. He says this vegetable is the perfect example of a seed-to-stem food because you can use the entire plant. And he writes about all the different products that you can be making from okra in his new book, The Whole Okra, A Seed-to-Stem Celebration. He shares okra recipes and dishes from famous chefs, the cultural history of the plant, and even some gardening tips. I say pick it early because it'll get big in the next hour. He also includes non-food recipes and how to make okra paper. Chris Smith, executive director of the Utopian Seed Project, serves on the board of the People's Seed and joins us from Blue Ridge Public Radio in downtown Asheville. Welcome to The State of Things, Chris.
Hey, Frank. Happy to be here.
Have you loved okra all your life? I detect not a Southern accent, and I don't know if...
I do not.
It's a worldwide food, I know, but I mean, I'm wondering how you first learned about okra.
It's definitely a worldwide food, but maybe a little more restricted to the central regions around the equator, so, you know, like subtropical region. I do not have a Southern accent. I'm from England, and I did not experience okra until I was 26 years old.
And what was that experience like for you?
Well, it wasn't the best experience, and maybe a lot of people can empathize that the first time they eat okra, they don't like it. I was in a roadside greasy spoon in Clayton, Georgia, and a friend was kind of playing a tourist prank on us and persuaded us to eat some nasty deep-fried okra.
Deep-fried? You mean you didn't like, because that's the only way. A lot of people will, because people will eat, you know, mulch if you deep-fry it, but even that, you didn't like it.
Well, there's a way to get it wrong when you deep fry it. I think this was old, nasty, greasy spoon type oil.
Yeah.
It was probably frozen okra. It'd probably been sitting in a pan for too long. You know, you can get okra really wrong, and I think that's one of the problems we experience with it.
You did have a second experience with okra, and that was a little different for you, right?
Yeah. Definitely a redemptive experience. I grew up in a gardening family and grew up, you know, vegetables from the garden, and my mom's a big-time home gardener. So when I came to America in 2012 to get married to my Southern wife, fiancé at the time, then she kind of forced me to go to her bridal shower, which for a British person is a terrible thing to do. But I sat there and received all these gifts from people and had to say nice things and all that sort of stuff. But one of those gifts was a dried okra pod. And as a gardener, the seeds and the stories behind those seeds were just absolutely incredible to me. And I was very excited to go ahead and plant that okra. And that gave me the chance to re-experience it and start this journey.
Well, let's talk more about that journey and the cultural history of okra. You know, take us back, its origins to the extent that we know them, and how it made its way around the world.
Yeah, for sure. It's somewhat disputed still of like where okra's true home is, but we can kind of pin it down to Ethiopia as a certainly an area where it was domesticated, although it may have traveled first in more of a wild form from Asia type region. But we think it was domesticated in Ethiopia, and then from there it traveled east into Asia and then across the African continent, and then it came across the Americas with the slave trade and started off in kind of Brazil, moved up through Central America, and finally made it to North America.
What are some of the, is this, I mean, how far back does it go? And there are fascinating sort of myths and legends that are associated with this plant.
Yeah, it definitely goes back to like antiquity, but it's in the written record, there's not that much information about it. So there's more mythology around other plants that we find in the botanical world. For okra, there's stories told, but little reference that I've been able to back this up with of, you know, Cleopatra using it in ancient Egypt, and there's certainly some early references to it in cultivation there. But a lot of our stories about okra are more, you know, certainly in the Americas, 18th century based around cultivation, and then it was adopted into more Western culture, but it was all influenced by ancient African uses, like with the West African preparation of okra soups and that kind of thing, influenced things like the gumbos that we experience in the South today.
And there are farmers, this I found fascinating, the idea that you would, that it helps to beat your okra while it's growing.
Yeah, I came across this one. Somebody told me about switching okra, and initially I thought they were talking about swapping it for something more desirable, but I realized what they meant was these old farmers used to pay a kids basically to run through their fields. They used to pay them a nickel to run through with a stick and whack the okra with the stick. And it kind of induced this sort of trauma response that induced the plants to create more flowers. And then from the flowers, we have the pods. So it was kind of stressing the okra out to make it go, oh no, we must create more pods to create more seeds to continue
this,
our life.
Is this the science, or botanical research back this up or?
Yeah, the guy that told me about that was a garden writer called Felder Rushing, who's pretty well researched. And he said that there was this stress hormone called traumatin. Now, I've not found a whole bunch of peer-reviewed papers to back that up, but that's what he reported to me.
Now, this is interesting because this backs up my theory that if you let it grow long enough and just don't bother to pick it, just leave it out there on the plant long enough, you can actually use okra as a murder weapon. This has been, I think it's been proven, although, you know, some of the evidence got thrown out. I've heard of chicory being used as a substitute for coffee, but not okra. You found out that it was.
Yeah, the okra seed, not the okra pods. So if you let the pod go through to murder weapon stage, then within that pod, you have all these dry, kind of bullet-like seeds, really small seeds, and they can be roasted and ground. And in the Civil War era, then there's a whole bunch of stuff, actually. It's not just chicory, but things like rye, sweet potatoes, and okra seeds were all investigated for use as a coffee substitute. And it's funny, there's newspapers dated to the 1860s, 61, 62, that are headlining with okra seed, the world's best Java, and grow okra seeds, it will be your coffee hero type thing.
Yeah. And no caffeine, though. There's no caffeine.
No caffeine, although the seeds do have this high antioxidant activity, which has been kind of linked to some anti-fatigue effects. So no caffeine, but potentially some low-level stimulus there. The bigger problem with using okra seed as an okra coffee is that it has no coffee-like flavor.
Yeah.
That's the biggest disappointment.
It's really you tried it,
not
right?
A substitute. Oh, yeah. I was excited about the idea of using okra seed as a coffee substitute. And actually, when you roast the seeds and grind them, the aromatics that come off that freshly ground okra seed are just really nutty, rich, coffee-esque in their kind of flavor. You can imagine what it would taste like. But as soon as you do any form of water extraction, that flavor drops away and you're left with kind of a weak, earthy oolong tea. So not unpleasant, but when you're all geared up for having a strong cup of coffee, that's not what you get. If you
smelled it roasting. So this book, now you're in Asheville and you partnered with several small businesses and local experts in Asheville. Tell us more about that, because they helped you do some experiments, right?
Yeah, that was one of the fun things that I really wanted to bring to this project. You know, I didn't grow up with the okra culture or okra history on my own bones. I just came to America and discovered okra. And then discovered the resistance to okra and was like, this isn't fair. The okra is actually quite incredible. But I knew I couldn't really celebrate and tell this story without a whole bunch of voices. So all the recipes in the book are contributed, or most of the recipes are contributed by food writers or chefs or bakers. And then a lot of the businesses around Asheville were able to kind of collaborate with me. So, for example, there's a really awesome spice company. She kind of does table. She's called Well Seasoned Table. And I gave her some okra seeds and asked her to experiment. And she made this beautiful roasted okra seed sea salt. Owl Bakery, they did a okra seed sourdough and an okra seed savory muffin. And the flavors that come through there, there's this kind of, those flavors from the roasted seeds are kind of nutty and rich. And even though they don't make a coffee, they make a really nice flour.
So she actually made flour. It's not like roasting the seeds and putting them on top or adding them to the dough. You're using some of the actual flour.
For sure. And those seeds, when they're roasted, they have this high protein content. So actually there's some, again, West African preparations where they're using the okra seed flour for a fortification agent in traditional breads to really enhance the nutrition within those breads. So it's got some research.
Talk about the nutritional value and virtues of okra.
So you introduced with seed to stem celebration. So when you say okra, I think, which part of okra are you talking about? You know, but I realize that most people are talking about the okra pod. So if we're thinking about the pod, then it's obviously very low in calories and then high in both soluble and insoluble fibers. And then it's pretty high in vitamins A, K, and C. So it makes it a, you know, you can eat a lot of this and you're not going to put on a lot of calories, but you're going to bring a lot of decent vitamins into you. And then the minerals are magnesium, calcium, and potassium is where it really shines. So you get a pretty good range of nutrients from eating
yeah,
it. But
those
really
minerals,
those insoluble fibers are what makes it good for the digestion and good for the body in general.
Yeah, and those trace minerals, which we often don't get enough of, that's handy. I will say, if you eat okra the way I eat it, you will put on a few pounds, but but I take your point. There are ways to eat it and not have that happen.
You can eat it raw. That's one way you should, you know, if you're growing okra, go out into the field and eat it raw, and you really get an appreciation for the flavors when you do that. It's really quite delicious.
And there have to be different varieties. It's very interesting because, you know, I make this joke about it, okay, and anybody who's ever grown okra, at least in these parts, knows that, you know, if it looks kind of okay, like about the right size in the morning, you better get it, because an hour later it's going to be a murder weapon. It's going to be like, it's going to be 7 feet long. But there must be various varieties, because I have a son-in-law from South India. I've been there, and they have these giant okras. I mean, like 2 feet long. They're translated into drumstick is what they call them, and they're not the least bit. I mean, they cook, and you can eat them, and they're not, you know, a giant piece of wood. So apparently there are lots of varieties of okra.
Yeah. I think this is true of all food, to be honest. I work for a seed company here in Asheville, So True Seed, and we have all these different varieties of all these different crops. But you walk into the supermarket, and you only see one variety. You know, we live in a monoculture world in the supermarket, even though you can grow a whole bunch of stuff. And so with okra specifically, last year I grew 76 different varieties of okra. This year I have an entirely different 50 in the ground. The USDA has like these gene banks, and they have over 1,000 accessions of okra. Once you get onto the Asian continent, and India has a gene bank with over 4,000 accessions. Mm. So there's a ton of diversity once you get into it that, you know, should be explored and celebrated.
All right, let's talk about what you can do with it other than deep fry it. Something I had not heard of before. I'd heard of Hoppin' John, but not Limpin' Susan. Tell us about Limpin' Susan.
Yeah, it's kind of like different sources will say that Limpin' Susan is Hoppin' John's like cousin or wife or daughter. And it's definitely the less well-known dish, but a chef from Charleston, Chef B.J. Dennis, has Gullah Geechee roots, and he created this wonderful Charleston dish, which is basically you have shrimp and you have the okra, and you fry it all together, and it often has bacon in it, and you serve it over rice, and it's just a real nice, crispy way to present all the okra together.
You kind of put them in all at once, or do you have to stage it to get things to cook at the right done points?
He starts off by charring the okra a little bit just to get it crisped up. There's, when we talk about the slime in okra, which is one of people's main complaints with okra, then there's all sorts of different ways you can prepare the okra to mitigate the slime. And one of those ways is to really bring high heat to it that will cut through the slime. So if you kind of hot fry the okra in a shallow pan, then that will cut through some of the slime and char it slightly, which brings out some of the nutty sweetness of the pods. And then you add in all the other ingredients in one big go. And just, it's kind of like a stir fry, I guess.
We're talking about the book, The Whole Okra, Seed to Stem Celebration. You can find out more at our website and get the recipe for Limpin' Susan at our website, stateofthings.org. Chris Smith is the author, and I'm talking with him. We mentioned the fact that you are in Asheville, and you worked with a chef and restaurant owner up there, Merwin Irani, who tried an experiment with the leaf, right?
Yeah. Merwin was great. He had a whole bunch of different parts to play in the book. The leaf was part of it, that maybe the least successful part. He's known for his restaurant, Chai Pani, where they serve okra fries. And every single presentation I've ever given in the greater Asheville area about okra, many people come up to me at the end and say, have you tried the okra fries at Chai Pani? They're really, really popular. But I wanted to celebrate the rest of the plant and was trying to get people to be involved with that. So I took him some okra leaves, mainly because he makes this dish in his restaurant called kale pakoras. And I obviously don't know as much about making pakoras as I thought I did, because I took him these leaves and asked him to make okra leaf pakoras. And the leaves themselves have a great taste, but like the rest of the plant, they have these spines on them that can be irritating to the skin. And I didn't really give much thought about the spines, because I thought he was going to plunge them in deep oil and that would eliminate them. But when you make pakoras, you mix all that batter around the leaves, and some of the leaf is exposed to the hot oil and some isn't. And it turned out that when I checked in on him a week or so after he made these okra leaf bakar is he agreed that the flavor was really good, but complained to some degree that I'd fed him a product that irritated his throat and all the okra leaves that had been caught within the batter had maintained their hairiness and spininess. And poor Chef Irani.
Maybe if you batter dipped them and really kind of deep fried the whole thing. Well, anyway.
Yeah, that's why. So another chef, Ian Bowden, has actually won an All-Star Chef Award with an okra-based dish, and he garnished it with just straight-up deep-fried okra leaves, so kind of like a kale leaf chip. He did an okra leaf chip just by taking the whole baby leaf and plunging it in hot oil.
You also have a recipe for a spicy okra, right? Spicy okra, I think that's what it's called, an Ethiopian recipe?
Yeah, I was really keen to include a recipe from Ethiopia, or at least with Ethiopian origins. One of the classic preparations from Ethiopia is bamia elitcha, and this dish from Marcus Samuelson is kind of a play on that. It's pretty much exactly the same. He's thrown peanuts in, and it's a little spicier, but it's a similar. You see a lot of preparations with okra where they pair it with tomatoes. So the other way you can mitigate the slime is by getting okra and adding an acid. So pickled okra with acetic vinegar will cut through the slime. Or you see across the whole world, actually, not just in the South, you see okra and tomato stews or sauces or stir fries. And so this has the tomatoes and the okra and then the chilies. And he's thrown some peanuts in there. And it's just a good way to have a pretty simple, clean, healthy dish. And I think that one's served traditionally over rice as well.
Chris, I think you've won a few converts. Nice job.
I hope so.
Chris Smith is the author of The Whole Okra, A Seed to Stem Celebration. He is also executive director of the Utopian Seed Project, serves on the board of the People's Seed, and joined us from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you, Frank.
We've got links to the book and the recipes at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus, along with Will Cumbo. Robin Copley is our technical director. Lee Wilcher, our engineer in Asheville. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.